The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks for subscribing or downloading. And really, we appreciate when you let people know about the program. Lots of new listeners have come to us as a result of someone sending a text or sharing it on their phone. So really appreciate all of that. If you'd like to contact us on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us. We're at @NewsTalkScience. We get to all of those comments in the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to ask an interesting question about ancient myths and legends that have been passed down from, you know, prehistory. And the question is, could we possibly learn something about the way the world was from these ancient myths? Did they come from somewhere? Was the inspiration perhaps something like a geological event? Patrick Nunn, who's a professor of geology in Australia, certainly thinks so anyway. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us via Skype is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with sugar, Ruth, or at least a new way of regulating sugar, a rather ingenious device.
Yes, it does. This is a device which might help people with diabetes. And I have to say, I was staggered when I started looking into this story to read that we're approaching a point where almost 10% of the world's population is suffering from diabetes or a pre-diabetic condition. So the kind of scale of the problem here is pretty significant. Now, with diabetes, as you say, that's the body's inability to regulate sugar metabolism. And there's two main types of diabetes. People might have heard of type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is when the body's own cells don't produce the chemical insulin to deal with sugar. And type 2 is probably the more common one. Well, it is by far the more common one. And this is the one which lifestyle activity are the one that impact on it, so obesity. And this is where your body stops responding to insulin. So researchers in Italy have developed an ingenious device to help people deal with diabetes. So the common way for people to deal with diabetes is to inject themselves with extra insulin so that they can manage their blood sugar levels. But that requires multiple injections during the course of a day and all the issues that come with that. So this device, it reminds me a little bit of the International Space Station. Imagine there's a device the size of about a pack of cards, and that actually gets surgically implanted into the abdomen just under the stomach. And it sits there all the time. And the idea is that you don't even feel it. And then you can swallow a little magnetic pill, and that pill makes its way down into your small intestine, and a magnetic field from the implanted device attracts the pill and moves it slowly into position where it docks right beside the device, which can then shoot out a tiny needle through the wall of the abdomen, suck the insulin chemical into the device, and then the little pill just moves through your abdomen and comes out in the toilet. And this can just happen. It means you can take your insulin by taking this little magnetic pill, maybe once or twice a day, no more injections. Really incredible technology.
So where are they in terms of making this available to patients?
Well, they've used it in 3 pigs successfully. So they have a very good model of diabetes in pigs. Pigs are used quite commonly in human disease models. Now, one of the main issues they currently have is just the sealing of the device. So that's what they're currently working on. And I guess the reason why they're so excited about this is because it actually managed to stabilize the blood sugar in the pigs for significant periods of time without additional interventions. And of course, it's not just diabetes where people need to have long infusions of drugs. I mean, we've all seen, you know, if we've experienced chemotherapy or seen people taking chemotherapy, often patients are sitting with an infusion with a needle for long periods of time. Mm. So I think that's where this kind of technology could really be revolutionary for patients, where rather than having to be in a hospital or injecting yourself with all the risks of infection, you could be taking a pill that's then been administered through this pump in your body.
What about the device itself? I mean, obviously surgeries would be required to install it. Does that need to be replaced regularly? Or obviously you need to be careful when you're putting foreign objects into your body.
Yeah, and one of the issues, of course, is the power for the device as well. Now, this device charges wirelessly. So again, that's fantastic. It means it can be charged without any additional opening of the body. And I suppose that's the real goal here, to administer drugs without, you know, creating a route for infection to get in. So yes, there is a surgery initially, but after that, if the device works, it should require pretty minimal maintenance.
And of course, that's amazing, especially for kids who have to do this, you know, from an early age, trying to get around it, the regularity of it. It's so much easier and more, I suppose, in some ways, socially acceptable to take a pill for something rather than have to inject yourself, particularly when you're a young child. Shane, our second story has to do with caterpillars.
It does. Not hungry caterpillars in this story. It's unfortunately a sad story about the alarming decrease in moth caterpillar populations in England. It's happening. We know that it's happening in England because a study is done there. This is not just particular to England. So this is work by the UK Centre for Ecology, and they looked at the effect of streetlights on caterpillar populations. And they looked at three scenarios, one where there's no lights, one where there's the old sodium lights, the orangey colored lights we're familiar with, and the newer LED lights, which are the very energy efficient bulbs, and they're far bluer, we'll know that. And they looked at the populations in hedges, first of all, and they saw that under a sodium light, there was a 40% decrease of caterpillars compared to no light. And shockingly, under LEDs, there was a 50% decrease under the street light. And that's huge. That really is huge. A 50% population decrease is enormous. People are like, well, moths, you know, big deal. So moths are pollinators. They're also food for lots of animals, such as birds. And the authors in this paper are saying, this is a real sign of the biodiversity crisis linked to the climate crisis. And these sort of ones are gentle. There is an insect apocalypse. That's the scientist phrase. Scientists are not one to use phrases like that willy-nilly. And they say, you know, the insect world is disappearing around us. Mm. And this is going to have huge impacts. They say, this is good news, there's a really good solution here. So all these new LED lights, they can be dimmed. They're very easy to control. They can also put filters in them to take out the blue light, which seems to be affecting the moths more. And of course, we can just program them to turn them off. So I don't know if you've been on holidays in parts of Germany where at night, most of the streetlights just dim and then go off at a certain point. So you don't need streetlights on at 4 o'clock in the morning unnecessarily. We just have to accept that sometimes it gets dark.
Yeah, but with moths, I thought moths were supposed to like the light.
They do, but of course, when a moth is under a light, they're easy to spot by their prey. And so this could be part of the reason why they're disappearing, is that once they turn into moths, they go to the light and then they're eaten very quickly.
And so they don't make caterpillars either, which is by laying the eggs in the first place. With streetlights, I suppose that is a habitat, I suppose, these hedgerows, but is it very difficult for these moths to adapt to that and move to somewhere less well lit?
Yes, because hedgerows are really one of the few very wild places left in urban and suburban environments. Even in agricultural environments, the hedges at the edges are where all the insect life lives. Your grass and fields of corn, they're effectively homogenous places in terms of wildlife. There's very little going on in them. It's all at the edge.
Right. Ruth, our third story has to do with ancient DNA from bears' teeth.
Yes, well, it has to do with plaque. And look, we all know what plaque is. It's that stuff that has to get scraped away when we go to the dentist. But actually, it's a hardened layer of bacteria that builds up on our teeth and can damage them by producing acid. And bears get it too. The reason this study is interesting is that it looks at the components of those bacteria and it looks at it over time. So it looks to see how they changed. So researchers in Sweden and Norway were looking at bear skulls from about the last 70 years, and they noticed that the skulls had plaque on the teeth. And they thought, well, that's interesting. We could examine that plaque and see what kind of bacteria are living on these bear's teeth. So they painstakingly scraped this thin layer off all of these bear's teeth going back to about the 1950s. And it's really amazing what they saw. Antibiotics became widely used in about the 1950s. And across the whole world, these were miracle drugs, and they were put into everything, in people, in veterinary medicine, in agriculture. And what was amazing was how quickly after they started to be used, that they penetrated all aspects of ecology, including these wild animals living sometimes, you know, tens of thousands of kilometers away from where one might see this activity of administering antibiotics. So clearly the antibiotics were able to spread very quickly once they got into the ecosystem. So what they actually saw in these samples was the bacteria that they sequenced were acquiring genes for antibiotic resistance. And the number of genes for antibiotic resistance increased with time, with the increased use of by humans of antibiotics.
Wow.
And in fact, it was nearly double in only about 20 years, the number of these genes doubled in the bacteria that they were finding in these very remote species. So of course, they questioned, I mean, how were these animals becoming exposed to antibiotics? So they looked at a number of different possibilities, and really they felt it was probably through water. So, you know, it could have also been through the bears eating, other animals that have been infected, but they felt that probably the leaching of antibiotics into the water system, it was probably the main route. And of course, this idea that we can use water across the globe as a kind of dilution, that there's enough of it that we can just keep putting things in it, and that dilution factor will be enough to not cause any impact. I mean, that's something that probably we still do far, far too much of, but it's not going to work. And this study shows that very, very quickly, even the most remote parts of nature will be impacted on things that we put into water systems.
Shane, our final story has to do with emotional diversity. This is a new one on me. What is emotional diversity?
Yeah, it's work from the University of South Florida in the Journal of Gerontology, and they have collected data from 3,000 middle-aged, healthy, educated participants in the USA. So that's diverse. And they've looked at the time that these guys spend doing one of seven things and their emotions as they're doing them. So the seven things are paid work, time with kids, doing chores, leisure, physical activity, and helping others outside the home. And those 3,000 people had to self-report their emotional state as they were doing them. I'm very skeptical about this sort of approach. How do you define things like cheerful or good spirit, proud, active, nervous, upset, lonely? These are completely subjective. Your sense of what lonely is and mine might be very different, but this isn't stopping this crew in South Florida. And they have suggested that more emotional diversity is associated with doing more things in your day and your time. So if you're doing lots of different things, you're going to experience lots of emotional diversity, and that's good for you, they suggest. They also say that when you get older, according to their study, you're less likely to experience the highs and the lows of this emotional diversity. What I would suggest is that perhaps older people are more conservative in filling out these forms than their younger counterparts. I find this kind of science absolute rubbish.
Yeah, okay, good to know. You're experiencing an emotion right now. I have to say, as an emotional person, I look forward to my old age where everything just gets to mellow out. But having spent time with my parents, I have to say, with a sample size of two, they experience a lot of emotions a lot of the time too.
Well, if I was related to you, Jonathan, I might too, yeah, you know?
I'm not sure there's much more we can get out of this story, so let's leave it there. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, thanks very much. Now, as a country of storytellers, we're well used to mythology, stories of lost lands like Tir-na-n-Og, ghostly figures, strange creatures and lost civilizations. But where do these ancient stories come from? And can they always be just disregarded as fiction? A new book explores what legend can tell us about the true history of our world. It's called Worlds in Shadow. It's written by Patrick Nunn. He's a professor of geography and co-director of the Sustainability Research Centre at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia. He joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I'm delighted to be here.
I've always been interested in ancient stories of lost creatures and mythology. The mythology of Ireland has been fascinating to me. And I suppose it makes sense to sort of query where these stories come from a cultural sense, because while there are similarities across the world in some ways, there are, you know, hero stories, these creatures to defeat and so on. Culturally, and some of the details of these ancient stories seem very particular and peculiar to that place. So I wanted to ask you why you were interested in looking at mythology, and what sort of myths and legends did you look at for this book?
Well, thank you. I grew up like you, and probably most of your listeners, sort of hearing these kinds of stories, these myths and legends, and, you know, parking them in one part of my brain that sort of said not to take them seriously, to consider them to be entertainments. But I'm a geologist by training, and as time has gone on, I've got to think a lot more about the possible meanings of these stories. And I've come to the conclusion, particularly from working in Australia and the Pacific Islands, where there's still a lot of vibrant oral cultures, I've come to the conclusion that our ancestors, who could neither read nor write, were not imaginative in the way that we might consider them to be imaginative when we look at these kinds of stories. They were pragmatists, and everything was produced and passed on for a reason. And I think the more I think about this, the more I'm convinced that it's correct in the great number of cases.
It sort of makes sense that the important stories that got handed down from generation to generation were ones that were key to survival, that may have had something to do with natural disasters or important things to note that may be a cause of danger or concern not far away.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think ancient societies were as risk-averse as we are today, and anything that they could do to prepare future generations to cope with the challenges that they and their ancestors had been through, they did. And I just wanted to give you a really good example that I think you talk about myths being worldwide. Well, myths about giants and giant beings are worldwide. And I often used to wonder about those. And now I'm actually convinced that they represent the legacy of a time when the ocean surface, the sea level, was much lower than it is today. And people were able to walk between land masses that they can't walk between today, like Wales and Ireland, or Scotland and Ireland, for example. As the sea level rose and drowned these connections, the memory of a time when people had been able to walk across there persisted, and it became part of history. It became part of folklore, for a better want of a better word. And to make those stories believable, as the sea level had risen and drowned the land connection, to make those stories believable, the people had to be giant beings who could actually walk across ocean gaps without getting their feet wet. So I think many stories, not all of course, but many stories about giant beings evolved from the rise of sea level, drowning land connections that people had crossed formerly.
Of course, the legend of Finn McCool and Ben and Donna is about the Giant's Causeway and ripping up tracts of land and creating lakes and islands and so on. So, I mean, that perfectly fits with this idea that that's how these things got to be.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely, yes. I think that's a really good example. But, you know, I think it's more than that. So I think people in the past wanted to conserve their memories and their ancestors' memories of these kinds of catastrophic landscape changing events for the future. because if they recurred again, then people need to know that they were survivable. And a good example of volcanic eruptions. You know, in many parts of the world, volcanic eruptions don't occur very often. But when they do occur, their impacts can be catastrophic for particular societies. So I think many societies retained the memory of what actually happened in a volcanic eruption to pass on to future generations in case it should happen again. And could I just give you one brilliant example that I've got a research student working on at the moment from Northern Queensland here in Australia. And it refers to a volcanic eruption that took place 7,000 years ago. And the local people, the Gugubadun indigenous people there, they have stories of this event 7,000 years ago. They talk about a witch doctor making a big hollow in the ground and scooping out the sand and sending it all across the landscape and asphyxiating people, causing them to lose their way and things like that. Talks about the river valleys filling with fire and things like that. All of it is consistent with what we know as geologists about this volcanic eruption.
There's also a story about people of the Aran Islands that I was interested in, who claimed not so long ago that they could see the lands of High Brazil. What did they mean by that, do you know? And where might such an idea have come from?
Well, I'd never be so presumptuous as to tell people from the west coast of Ireland what their ancestors thought. But if you ask me as a scientist, I think these kinds of stories all represent memories, cultural memories of a time when the sea level was lower and the sea level rose across the land, submerging it and displacing the people who lived there. And this event was so traumatizing that it became etched, if you like, into the collective memory of the people who lived there. And it is periodically revitalized, you know, with sightings of islands like High Brazil. And certainly in the Aran Islands, people used to claim to see High Brazil on a regular basis, an island far out to sea, but clearly to them, an island. And people tried to reach it, but of course they never did. And a lot of my research career has been spent in the Pacific Islands. And there is an almost parallel example in Fiji, around an island called Borotokula, which can be, you know, wanders around the Fiji Islands, and people see it from time to time, particularly, you know, as a kind of auspicious event about to happen or something like that. So I think that is one example of the way in which cultures have retained memories of submerged lands in places like the west coast of Ireland.
Take me through some of the science then, because I suppose, like evolutionary psychology, sometimes you get an explanation that seems to fit really well. And what you're saying to me really does seem to fit well. But as a science broadcaster, there's a sort of niggling voice saying, OK, well, that sounds OK, but how do you prove it? Or how do you go about getting a theory? And if you're doing, I suppose, proper evolutionary psychology, you then have to go and take that theory and say, well, if that was true, then we should find these other things and then see if those ideas become true. As a trained geologist and scientist, how do you look at the science, at the geology of a land and say, okay, well, that fits with my predictions or my projections for why this story has become a legend in this land?
Well, let's jump back to the last ice age. Around about 20,000 years ago, Ireland was connected to England and Scotland and Wales. It was connected to mainland Europe because the sea level was so much lower. The sea level was about 120 meters lower than it is today. And the reason it was lower was because so much ocean water had been sucked up to build ice sheets on the land, because it was much colder during the Ice Age.
Within oral history memory.
Well within potential human memory, yes. And we know that there were hominids in this part of in your part of Europe. Whether they were Homo sapiens or whether they were something else is, I have to say, it's not entirely certain, but that's not my area of specialism. So at the end of the last ice age, all the ice started to melt, water poured into the ocean and raised the level of the ocean, drowning all these lands that people and the animals that they hunted had been accustomed to moving across. And so gradually, the English Channel formed, the Irish Sea formed, the North Sea formed, and the British Isles and Ireland became islandized, if you like. And it wasn't just a question of becoming islands, it was also a question of becoming cut off from the land that you used to be connected to. So the geology is really indisputable. And I think one of the interesting things is that, you know, all this began in the late 19th century with Edmund Suess, a geologist from Austria who looked at the ice ages and sea levels. Almost every geologist then has assumed that they've discovered something new. But of course, our ancestors were around at the time. And this is something that I go to geology conferences and I say all the time. I say, what is the problem in believing that there are extant human memories of these events? People observed these things happening.
Yeah, you know? And you can imagine these things being so terrifying. And inexplicable. You can imagine that they would form a cornerstone of a society's folklore. Absolutely. Talk to me about the island of Hawaiki.
Hawaiki is the homeland that many people in the Pacific Islands believe their ancestors came from. And no one knows exactly where it is. But in many oral histories in the Pacific Islands, Hawaiki is actually under the sea. And it's quite possible that, you know, Pacific Island people that we see there today migrated from the Western Pacific, the fringes of the Western Pacific Ocean, at a time the sea level was rising, and they were displaced from the lands that they'd occupied. And there's been some very interesting work done in Southeast Asia, island Southeast Asia, an area that we referred to as Sunda, S-U-N-D-A. And Sunda was basically an extension of the Asian continent during the last ice age. And as the sea level rose, it became flooded and people were displaced from there. And one of the big questions, really interesting questions, is whether those people had already learned how to domesticate rice and whether they were really already rice farmers. And that their dispersion actually dispersed the understanding of how to grow domesticated rice throughout Southeast Asia. I have to say the Chinese don't like that very much. They claim the rice was rice originated in the Yangtze Valley. But you know, no one's really going to ever be able to come up with a final answer on this.
In the book, you even go as far as to suggest that the myths and legends of mermaids and mermen may actually be based in historical events. Can you explain that?
Oh, of course. I don't think that. For one moment, mermaids and mermen exist. But at the same time, I don't think that they are solely figments of the imagination. You can go back to Hesiod writing about 3,000 years ago and find stories about mermaids and King Triton and people like that living beneath the ocean. And so I think that this is actually something that's very deeply rooted in many cultures. And again, I would say that it's a cultural memory in many cases of a time when people lived on lands that are now submerged, as they did around most coastlines in the world, including, of course, off the west coast of Ireland. And when that land goes underwater, not only is place lost, but also people are lost and associations are lost. And the survivors, the people who actually managed to not survive, but the people who remain in that place, if they don't read or write, then their only option is to encode their memories of these events into oral traditions. And my point here is that oral traditions, as time goes on, become less and less believable. So in order to keep them alive, you sometimes have to exaggerate things. You have to talk about giants. You have to talk about mermaid sightings and things like that to make the tradition continue to be relevant to each new generation. So yes, I mean, I sometimes think that we dismiss a whole lot of interesting stories of this kind at our peril, really.
Atlantis is obviously the thing that's sticking out in most people's heads, the sort of mythological underground lost civilization. Is there any cultural explanation for that? I mean, is that something that you buy into, that Atlantis may have existed or may have been a civilization lost to the sea that led to that story?
I think almost certainly not. And I think that the acid test there is that Atlantis has been discovered in probably 200 or 300 places all the way around the world. And clearly, if it existed, then all but one of those has to be false. Atlantis was a story that was dreamed up by Plato about 2,300 years ago. And Plato used the story of Atlantis to, as a vehicle, if you like, for talking about his vision of an ideal society. And he said, if you don't have this and this and this in an ideal society, then the gods will punish that society as Atlantis was punished, and right, it will be destroyed.
It was a fable.
It was a fable. But Plato was also a very good liar, and he enlivened his narrative and made it more believable by linking it to catastrophic events that had occurred in the Eastern Mediterranean in his lifetime or in the people's memory,
right,
including the volcanic eruption at Santorini, which destroyed the island, including you know, the ups and downs of the solid earth in places like Sparta and Athens, and large waves and things like that. So he wasn't short of a few catastrophes from which he could draw things.
So he was doing intentionally what you claim has been happening sort of generationally with these sort of mythologies. He sort of reversed the process.
He reversed the process. Yeah, no question about it. I think it's very sad in a way that there is so much belief in Atlantis, because there is no evidence for Atlantis.
Right.
You know, if it had existed, the geologists somewhere would have found evidence for it by now, but it simply doesn't exist. It may have been informed by one or two components of different lands being submerged in different places, but Atlantis as such never existed.
I'm sure this is hard to bring to academic conferences and bring people on board when you've got something as sort of fragmented as oral history, to try and get people to say we should incorporate this into our scientific understanding of the world. People might say, look, that's a lovely story, but where's your evidence? Do you find the academic world is very resistant to even look at oral histories when trying to piece together our history?
Oh, yes, without question. That said, there's a few exceptions. And I think the tide is turning. And I think one of the turning points was in 2006, when at the International Geological Congress in Florence, in Italy, they actually had a session on myth and geology. And I presented at that, and it was amazing. They had a room that could have about 200 people, and they had people standing at the back and, you know, listening outside the doors and everything else. So there's a lot of interest in it. But I get a sense these days that a lot of younger academics are a little bit timid when it comes to researching things that might seem to be a little bit fringe. But at the same time, if conventionally trained scientists like myself don't stand up and say this is how we can interpret this, or this is how we can interpret this, it's just going to be taken over by pseudoscientists, you know, people who will have you believe that, you know, extraplanetary beings sort of arrived and did this and did that, and that's, you know, by and large all absolute nonsense. And so I think people have a right to be informed about what the possible scientific thinking is on all this.
There's a sort of a duality there, isn't it? You're talking about you know, mythology that could inform our understanding being lost, and at the same time something similar is happening in academic circles. It's really interesting speaking with you. I could talk about this all day, I think. I mean, as a child, I devoured these sort of books, and this book is filled with the sort of a huge, a whirlwind tour of the globe of these fascinating little stories, and as a sort of an anthology of those, it's worth the ticket price in itself. But it's a really interesting look at the history and mythology of cultures and what it might say about the geology and the history of those civilizations. It's called Worlds in Shadow. The author is Patrick Nunn, Professor of Geography at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Patrick, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
There are so many myths and legends that are sort of missed in the childhood stories, because, like, you know, Fionn McCool and his stories, Tiernan and Og, they are easily wrapped up into a fable, easy to tell to children, and so they've been repeated over and over again. But books like The Tawn and other Irish stories that go off in sort of meandering avenues and go all over the place, they don't really fit so well into young education. And it seems to me that, at least my memory was, I didn't learn about The Tawn in school. I didn't read The Tawn in school. I read it outside of school. And I'm thinking there's so many of these myths and legends that relate to Ireland that are actually probably, they're just not passed down to young students today. Is that right? Maybe I'm misremembering. Send me an email, science@newstalk.com. Now, your comments from last week, we were talking about Havana syndrome, this mysterious illness that has befallen American and some Canadian diplomats, starting off in Cuba, and was considered to be possibly a secret weapon from the Russians or the Cubans, and it was all very James Bond. But we had a guy called Robert Bailo on. He said, it's just psychogenic mass illness. Your thoughts on that? Emin Athlone says, isn't there research that shows low frequency sounds can cause visual distortion and feelings of being watched? Cases of supposed haunting being put down to low frequency sound waves from oscillating air fans in some cases. I have not heard that you can induce the feeling of being watched or being haunted by playing low frequency sounds, but it's certainly something we're looking to. Jim Wexford says, when I heard of Havana syndrome first, it reminded me of old Soviet experiments in eavesdropping by bouncing sound waves off glass window panes. Jim, there is an advancement on that, apparently, in MIT. And I don't know if this is something that first arrived as a scientific paper and then the military jumped on it and now it's all top secret stuff, or if the claims in the original paper, or at least the press reports of it, were untrue. But what some researchers claim to have been able to do is to be able to look at the vibrations in liquids, even in old movies, and by looking at the detail of the vibrations, they could reverse engineer the sound of that room and essentially give a silent movie a soundtrack again. Now, that to me would be absolutely amazing, but also you could see the potential for military use. And so I don't know. I don't know if this paper was overstretching. I don't know if it was completely fabricated, but there was claims of this out there, and I haven't heard anything since. We've been trying to track it on the program for some time, but nobody seems to know what happened to that research since. So there's another James Bond mystery for you. Still on Havana syndrome, Ron says, your episode last week reminded me of this one from Malcolm Gladwell's revisionist history series, which looked at mass psychogenic illness. One case cited involved multiple school kids in Belgium who apparently got sick after drinking Coca-Cola. And they did an investigation. There's nothing wrong with the Coca-Cola. And it appeared to be someone got sick. They attributed it to the Coca-Cola. And then everyone then who had drunk Coca-Cola started manifesting these symptoms. And we know of something called the nocebo effect. That you can induce a placebo effect of negative feelings. You can tell someone you're going to take this pill. It's going to make you feel very bloated, and it might feel a slight pain in your throat, And we can actually induce those feelings in someone by giving them the expectation that that's going to happen with them. It's sort of the opposite of a placebo effect when it comes to medicine. And perhaps there's some sort of link between that and this mass psychogenic illness, which has happened so many times over history in lots of different ways, on airplanes and in small towns. And who knows, maybe it is, as John says, it's the same as the hysteria around moving statues or witnessing spiritual things in holy places. It's possibly just that contagion of hysteria that builds upon itself, like I mentioned in the interview, the Salem witch trials. Kieran has a sort of funny statement. He doesn't quite qualify. He says, "Hi, Jonathan. Maybe taking a closer look at the world around us is imprecise as a tagline for your show. Have you come across Donald Hoffman's work? The Case Against Reality is worth a look if you haven't come across it." I don't know if those two things are related, but I think it works. If you would like to suggest a new tagline for the show, "This has been going on far too long," for example, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We were also talking about pi. Shane Bergen told us that Google had spent a huge amount of time and money figuring out pi to a gazillion digits. And Gary says, "I did my own work on that and I came to a different constant." Man, this is embarrassing for them. And I don't know if this guy's name is Ashtown Phoenix or if his name is Phoenix and he's from Ashtown. But anyway, he says, "Ah, now pi, 40 odd decimal places will give the circumference of the universe to the accuracy of the width of a hydrogen atom. How accurate does it need to be?" Look, you're absolutely right. It doesn't really need to be that accurate. 40 digits seems that by your calculations, and I'll take your word for it, to be plenty, but it's not really about that, is it? It's about, I have no idea why they would want to do that. But some mathematicians get pure joy out of finding these answers. But also, don't they create ciphers by using really complicated numbers, like, you know, prime numbers going on to infinity? Can't you use those to create a really good encryption software? But that's the only application I can think of it. But good point, Ashtown or Phoenix, whoever you are. We were also talking about starlight, this really weird material that seems to have just been invented by a hairdresser in the 70s, but had the magical power of being super heat resistant. So heat resistant, in fact, that you could paint a thin layer of this on an egg and blast it with a flamethrower for hours, and the egg inside would not cook. And so this heat resistant property is hugely of interest to industry and manufacturers and even space organizations. And so there was a huge amount of interest in it, but the recipe kind of got lost. And we were telling the story of that last week. If you didn't hear it, it's a really good one. Mark says, "Your recent episode on starlight brought me back to my Erasmus experience many moons ago when I worked for 3 months in the Spanish arm of a large Belgian-based intumescent fire protection company. Active fire protection being water sprinklers, if you're interested to know. I worked for 3 months building a massive database by calling clients and confirming addresses. It was my first time using MS Access. 1 week to go, I managed to delete all of my work, all of it. Management ended up getting the whole office to ring everyone back in a week to build it back again. No fire-resistant paint could protect my blushes. I have hated MS Access since then." Do you know what? I think you and the rest of the world, Mark. But thanks for your story. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who's producing, Simon Keane and Garrett Mulhall, JJ Clark, as well as Steve McLoone, who was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.